paused at a window looking out, and rubbed absently at a small puckered mark on his chest that was not there any more.
"The Calway,"
said a tiny voice from his breast. He looked down, took a thing like a bead out of a shirt pocket. He clipped it to one ear, taking off his dark glasses and putting them in the pocket instead. "Hello?"
"It's me, Dizziot. You all right?"
"Yeah. I found a place to stay."
"Great. Listen. We found something. It's perfect."
"What?" he said, smiling at the excitement in Smar's voice. He pressed a button to close the curtains.
3,000 years ago, there was a guy who became a famous poet, wrote on wax tablets set in wooden frames. He did a group of 100 short poems he always maintained were the best things he ever wrote. But he couldn't get them published, and he decided to become a sculptor instead. He melted the wax from 98 of the tablets, keeping numbers 1 and 100, to carve a wax model, made a sand mould around it, and cast a bronze figure which still exists.
"Smar, is this leading anywhere?" he said, pressing another button to open the curtains again. He rather liked the way they swished.
"Wait. When we first found Verenhutz and did the standard total scan of each planet, we naturally took a hollow of the bronze statue, found some traces of the original casting sand and the wax in a cranny."
"And it wasn't the right wax?"
"It didn't match the two surviving tablets. So the GCU waited till it had finished the total scan and then did some detective work. The guy who did the bronze and who had done the poems later became a monk and ended up an abbot of a monastery. There was one building added while he was head man. Legend has it, he used to go there and contemplate the vanished 98 poems. The building has a double wall."
Smar's voice rose triumphantly.
"Guess what's in the cavity?"
"Walled in disobedient monks?"
"The poems, the waxes," Smar yelled.
Then her voice dropped a little.
"Well, most of them. The monastery was abandoned a couple of 100 years ago, and it looks like some shepherd lit a fire against a wall sometime and melted 3 or 4 of them. But the rest are there."
"Is that good?"
"Sir Calway, they're one of the great lost literary treasures of the planet. The University of Jan Saramol, where your pal Beishai's hanging out, has most of the guy's parchment manuscripts, the other two tablets, and the famous bronze. They'd give anything to get their hands on those tablets. Don't you see? It's perfect."
"Sounds all right, I suppose."
"Damn you, Sir Calway! Is that all you can say?"
"Dizzy, luck this good never lasts long. It'll average out."
"Don't be so pessimistic, Sir Calway."
"Okay, I won't," he sighed, closing the curtains again. There was a noise of exasperation from Dizzy at Smar.
"Well, I just thought I'd tell you. We'll be going soon. Sleep well."
The channel beeped closed. He smiled ruefully. He left the little terminal where it was, like an earring. He gave orders he was not to be disturbed, and as the night deepened, he turned all the heating up full and opened all the windows. He spent some time testing the balconies and drainage pipes around the outer walls. He climbed nearly to the ground and all the way round the facade as he tested ledges and pipes and sills and cornices for their strength. He saw lights in less than a dozen other guest rooms. When he was satisfied he knew the outside of the hotel, he returned to his floor. He leant on the balcony, a smoky bowl cradled in his hand. Occasionally, he lifted the bowl to his face and inhaled deeply. The rest of the time, he looked out over the sparkling city, whistling. Watching the light-speckled view, he thought while most cities looked like canvases spread flat and thin, Solitol was like a half-open book, a rippling, sculptured V sinking deep into the planet's geological past. Above, the clouds over the canyon and the desert glowed with orange-red light, reflecting the channeled flare of the city. He imagined that from the other side of the city, the hotel must look rather strange, with its topmost floor fully lit, the others practically black. He supposed he had forgotten how different the setting of the canyon made the city compared to others. Still, this too is similar, he thought. All is similar. He had been to so many different places and seen so much the same and so much utterly different that he was amazed by both phenomena. But it was true. This city was not so different from many others he'd known. Everywhere they found themselves, the galaxy bubbled with life and its basic foods kept on speaking back to it,
just like he told Shia's Engin, and thinking of her, felt again the texture of her skin and the sound of her voice. Still, he suspected if the culture had really wanted to, it could have found far more spectacularly different and exotic places for him to visit. Their excuse was that he was a limited creature, adapted to certain sorts of planets and societies and types of warfare. A martial niche, Smar had called it. He smiled a little grimly and took another deep breath from the drug bowl. The man walked past empty arcades and deserted flights of steps. He wore an old raincoat of a style unknown, but still somehow old-fashioned looking. He wore very dark glasses. His walk was economical. He appeared to have no mannerisms. He entered the courtyard of a large hotel, which contrived to look expensive and slightly run down at the same time. Dully dressed gardeners, raking leaves from the surface of an old swimming pool, stared at the man as though he had no right to be there. Men were painting the interior of the porch outside the lobby, and he had to work his way round them to get in. The painters were using specially inferior paint, made to very old recipes. It was guaranteed to fade and crack and peel in a most authentic manner within a year or two. The foyer was rich with decoration. The man pulled a thick purple rope near one corner of the reception desk. The clerk appeared, smiling.
"Good morning, Mr. Stabbereind. A pleasant walk?"
"Yes, thank you. Have breakfast sent up, will you?"
"Immediately, sir."
Solitol is a city of arches and bridges, where steps and pavements wind past tall buildings and lance out over steep rivers and gullies on slender suspension bridges and fragile stone arches. Roadways flow along the banks of watercourses, looping and twisting over and under them. Railways splay out in a tangle of lines and levels, swirling through a network of tunnels and caverns where underground reservoirs and roads converge. And from a speeding train, passengers can look out to see galaxies of lights reflecting on stretches of dark water, crossed by the slants of underground funiculars and the piers and ways of subterranean roads. He was sitting in the bed, dark glasses on the other pillow, eating breakfast and watching the hotel's own introductory tape on the suite screen. He switched the sound down when the antique telephone beeped.
"Hello?"
"Zakalwe."
It was Smar's voice.
"Good grief. You still here?"
"We're about to break orbit."
"Well, don't wait on my account."
He felt inside his shirt pocket and fished out the terminal bead.
"Why the phone? Is transceiver packed up?"
"No, just making sure there are no problems patching into the phone system."
"Fine. That all?"
"No. We've located Beishai more exactly. Still in John Saramol University, but he's in Library Annex 4. That's 100 meters under the city, the university's safest safe store. Quite secure at the best of times, and they have extra guards, though no real military."
"But where does he live? Where does he sleep?"
"The curator's apartments. They're attached to the library."
"He ever come to the surface?"
"Not that we can find out."
He whistled. "Well, that might or might not be a problem."
"How are things at your end?"
"Fine," he said, biting into a sweetmeat. "Just waiting for the offices to open. I've left a message with the lawyers to phone me. Then I start causing a fuss."
"All right. There shouldn't be any problems there. The necessary instructions have been issued, and you should get anything you want. Any problems, get in touch, and we'll fire off an indignant cable."
"Yeah.
Smart, I've been thinking,
just how big is this culture commercial empire, this Vanguard Corporation?"
"Vanguard Foundation. It's big enough."
"Yeah, but how big? How far can I go?"
"Well, don't buy anything bigger than a country. Look, Shiradineen, be as extravagant as you want in creating a fuss. Just get Beishai for us, quickly."
Yeah, okay."
"We're heading off now, but we'll keep in touch. Remember, we're here to help if you need it."
"Yeah, bye."
He put the phone down and turned the screen sound up again.
Caves, natural and artificial, are scattered through the rock of the canyon walls in almost as great a profusion as the buildings on the sloping surface. Many of the city's old hydroelectric sources are there, hollowed out into rock and humming, and a few small factories and workshops still survive, hidden away beneath the cliffs and shale, with only their stubby chimneys on the desert surface to show their position. This upward river of warm fumes counterpoints the network of sewage and drainage pipes, which also shows on the surface on occasion, and presents a complex pattern of tracery through the fabric of the city.
The phone beeped.
Hello? Mr. Stabagrand?
Yes.
Ah, yes. Good morning. My name is Kiaplo, of,
the lawyers.
Yes, thank you for your message. I have here a cable granting you full access to the income and securities of the Vanguard Foundation.
I know. Are you quite happy with this, Mr. Kiaplo?
Yes, the cable makes the position quite clear, though it is an unprecedented degree of individual discretion, given the size of the account. Not that the Vanguard Foundation has ever behaved exactly conventionally at any time.
Good. The first thing I'd like is to have funds sufficient to cover a month's hire of two floors of the Excelsior transferred to the hotel's account immediately. Then I want to start buying a few things.
Ah, yes, such as?
He dabbed at his lips with a napkin. Well, for a start, a street.
A street?
Yes, nothing too ostentatious, and it doesn't have to be very long, but I want a whole street, somewhere near the city centre. Do you think you can look for a suitable one immediately?
Yes, we can certainly start looking.
Good. I'll call at your offices in 2 hours. I'd like to be in a position to come to a decision then. Speed is essential, Mr. Kiaplo. Put your best people on it.
Yes, very well.
Good. I'll see you in a couple of hours.
Yes, right. Goodbye.
He turned the screen sound back up again.
Very little new building has been done for hundreds of years. Solitol is a monument, an institution, a museum. The factories, like the people, are mostly gone. Three universities lend areas of the city some life during part of the year, but the general air is said by many people to be archaic, even stultified, though some people enjoy the feel of living in what is, in effect, the past. Solitol has no skylighting. The trains still run on metal rails, and the ground vehicles must remain on the ground, because flying within the city or immediately above it is banned. A sad old place in many ways. Large sections of the city are uninhabited or only occupied for part of the year. The city is still a capital in name, but it does not represent the culture to which it belongs. It is an exhibit, and while many come to visit it, few choose to stay.
He shook his head, put his dark glasses on, and turn the screen off. When the wind was in the right direction, he blasted huge netted balls of paper money into the air from an old firework mortar mounted in a high roof garden. The notes drifted down like early snowflakes. He'd had the street decorated with bunting, streamers and balloons, and filled with tables and chairs and bars serving free drink. Covered ways extended the length of it, and music played. There were brightly coloured canopies over the important areas, such as the bandstands and the bars, but they were not needed. The day was bright and unseasonably warm. He looked out of one of the highest windows in one of the tallest buildings in the street and smiled at the sight of all the folk. So little happened in the city during the off-season that the carnival had attracted instant attention. He had hired people to serve the drugs and food and drink he had laid on. He had banned cars and unhappy faces, and people who didn't smile when they tried to get into the street were made to wear funny masks until they had livened up a bit. He breathed in deeply from where he leaned on the high window, and his lungs soaked up the heady fumes of a very busy bar just below. The drug smoke made it just this far up and hung in a cloud. He smiled, found it very heartening. It was all perfect. People walked around and talked together or in groups, exchanging their smoky bowls, laughing and smiling. They listened to the band and watched people dancing. They gave a great cheer each time the mortar fired. Many of them laughed at the leaflets full of political jokes that were given out with every bowl of drugs or food and every mask and novelty. They laughed, too, at the big, gaudy banners that were strung across the fronts of the dilapidated old buildings and across the street itself. The banners were either absurd or humorous, too. Pacifists against walls and experts, what do they know, were two of the more translatable examples. There were games and trials of wit or strength. There were free flowers and party hats and a much-frequented compliment stall where one paid a little money or gave a paper hat or whatever and was told what a nice, pleasant, good, unshowy, quiet-tempered, undemonstrative, restrained, sincere, respectful, handsome, cheerful, good-willed person one was. He looked down on all of this, Shades pushed up onto the tied-back hair above his forehead. Down there, submerged in it, he knew he would feel somehow apart from it all. But from his high vantage point, he could look down and see the people as a mass with different faces. They were far enough away to present a single theme, close enough to introduce their own harmonious variations. They enjoyed themselves, were made to laugh or to giggle, encouraged to get drugged and silly, captivated by the music, slightly deranged by the atmosphere. He watched two people in particular. They were a man and a woman, walking slowly through the street, looking all around. The man was tall and had dark hair cut short and kept artificially unkempt and curly. He was smartly dressed and carried a small dark beret in one hand. A mask dangled from the other. The woman was almost as tall and slimmer. She was dressed like the man in unfussy dark grey black, with a mandala of pleated white at her neck. Her hair was black, shoulder length, and quite straight. She walked as though there were many admiring people watching her. They walked side by side, without touching each other. They spoke now and again, merely tipping their heads in the direction of their companion, and looking to the other side, perhaps at what they were talking about as they spoke. He thought he remembered their photographs from one of the briefings on the GSV. He moved his head a little to one side to make sure the earring terminal had a good shot of them, then told the tiny machine to record the view. A few moments later, the two people disappeared beneath the banners at the far end of the street. They'd walked through the carnival without taking part in anything. The street party went on. A small shower came and drove people under the awnings and covers and into some of the small houses. But it was short, and more people were coming all the time. Small children ran with bright streamers of paper, winding coloured trails round posts and people and stalls and tables. Puff bombs exploded in smoky balls of coloured incense, and laughing, choking people staggered about, thumping each other's backs and shouting at the laughing children who threw the things. He drew away from the window, losing interest. He sat in the room for a little, squatting on an old chest in the dust, hand rubbing his chin, thoughtful, only raising his eyes when an upward landslide of balloons jostled up past the casement. He brought the dark glasses down. From inside, the balloons looked just the same. He walked down the narrow stairs, his boots clacking on the old wood. He took the old raincoat up from the rail at the bottom and let himself out of the rear door into another street. The driver pulled the car away, and he sat in the back as they rolled past the rows of old buildings. They came to the end of the street and turned into the steep road that ran at right angles to it and the street the party was in. They slid past a long, dark car with a man and a woman in it. He looked round. The dark car followed them. He told the driver to exceed the speed limit. They sped, and the car following them kept pace. He hung on and watched the city slithering past. They raced through some of the old government areas. The grand buildings were grey and heavily decorated with wall founts and water channels. Elaborate patterns of water ran down their walls in vertical waves, dropping like theatre curtains. There were some weeds, but less than he would have expected. He couldn't remember if they let the water walls ice up, turned them off, or added antifreeze. Scaffolding hung from many of the buildings. Workmen scratched and scraped at the worn stones and turned to watch the two big cars go tearing through the squares and plazas. He clung onto a grab handle in the rear of the car and sorted through a large collection of keys. They stopped in an old narrow street, down near the banks of the great river itself. He got out smartly and hurried into a small entrance under a tall building. The following car roared into the street as he closed but did not lock the door. He went down some steps, unlocking several rusting sets of gates. When he got down to the bottom of the building, he found the funicular car waiting on the platform. He opened the door, got in, and pulled the lever. There was a slight jerk as the car started off up the incline, but it ran smoothly enough. He watched through the back windows as the man and then the woman came out onto the platform. He smiled as they looked up and saw the car disappearing into the tunnel. The little coach struggled up the smooth slope into the daylight. At the point where the uphill and the downhill coach passed each other, he got out onto the outer platform of the car and stepped over onto the downhill coach. It ran on, propelled by the extra weight of water that it carried in its tanks, picked up from the stream at the high terminal of the old line. He waited a bit, then jumped out of that car, about a quarter of the way down, onto the steps at the side of the track.
He climbed up a long metal ladder into another building. He was sweating slightly by the time he got to the top. He took off the old raincoat and walked back to the hotel with it over his arm. The room was very white and modern-looking, with large windows. The furniture was integrated with the plasticized walls, and light came from bulges in the one-piece roof. A man stood watching the first snow of winter as it fell softly over the grey city. It was late afternoon and getting dark quickly. On a white couch, a woman lay face down, her elbows spread out, but her hands together under her side-turned face. Her eyes were closed, and her pale, oiled body was massaged with apparent roughness by a powerfully built man with grey hair and facial scars. The man at the window watched the falling snow in two ways. First, as a mass, with his eyes on one static point, so that the snowflakes became a mere swirl and the currents of air and gusts of light wind that moved them became manifest in patterns of circling, spiralling, falling. Then, by looking at the snow as individual flakes, selecting one high in the indeterminate galaxy of grey on grey, he saw one path, one separate way down through all the quiet hurry of the fall. He watched them as they hit the black sill outside, where they grew steadily but imperceptibly to form a soft white ledge. Others struck the window itself, sticking there briefly, then falling away, blown off. The woman seemed asleep. She smiled slightly, and the exact geography of her face was altered by the forces that the grey-haired man exerted on her back, shoulders and flanks. Her oiled flesh moved this way and that, and the gliding fingers seemed to provide force without causing friction, ribbing and creasing the skin like the smooth action of the sea on underwater grass. Her buttocks were covered by a black towel. Her hair was loose and spilling over part of her face, and her pale breasts were long ovals squashed beneath her trim body.
What is to be done, then?
We need to know more.
That is always true. Back to the problem.
We could have him deported.
For what?
We need to give no reason, though we could invent one easily enough.
That might start the war before we are ready for it.
Shush now. We must not talk of this war thing. We are officially on the best of terms with all our Federation members. There is no need for worry. Everything is under control,
said an official spokesman. Do you think we should get rid of him?
It may be the wisest course. One might feel better with him out of the way. I have a horrible feeling he must be here for a purpose. He has been given full use of the Vanguard Foundation's monies, and that willfully mysterious organization has opposed us every step along the road for 30 years. The identity and location of its owners and executives have been one of the cluster's best-kept secrets. Unparalleled reserve. Now, suddenly, this man appears, spending with a quite vulgar profligacy, and maintaining a high, if still coquettishly shy, profile, just when it might prove extremely awkward.
Perhaps he is the Vanguard Foundation.
Nonsense. If it's anything appreciable at all, it's some interfering aliens or a do-good machine, either running on some dead magnate's conscience will, or even running with a transcription of a human personality. Or it's a rogue machine, accidentally conscious with no one to oversee it. I think every other possibility has been discounted over the years. This man, Stabberind, is a puppet. He spends money with the desperation of an indulged child, worried such generosity will not last. He's like a peasant winning a lottery. Revolting. But he must, I repeat, be here for a purpose.
If we kill him and he turns out to have been important, then we might start a war, and too early.
Perhaps. But I feel we must do what is not expected. To prove our humanity. To exploit our intrinsic advantage of the machines, if for no other reason.
Indeed. But isn't it possible he could be of use to us?
Yes.
The man at the window smiled at his reflection in the glass and tapped out a little rhythm on the inside sill. The woman on the couch kept her eyes closed, her body moving to the steady beat of the hands that plied her waist and flanks.
But wait, there were links between Beishai and the Vanguard Foundation. If this is so...
If this is so, then perhaps we can persuade Beishai to our side using this person, this Stabberind.
The man put his finger to the glass and traced the path of a snowflake drifting down the other side. His eyes crossed as he watched it.
We could...
What?
adopt the de Hoovov system.
The... need to know more.
The de Hoovov system of punishing by disease. Great at capital punishment. The more serious the crime, the more serious the disease the culprit is infected with. For minor crimes, a mere fever, loss of livelihood and medical expenses. For more damaging misdeeds, a bout of something lasting perhaps months, with pain and a long convalescence, bills and no sympathy, sometimes marks to show later on. For really ghastly crimes, infection with disease is rarely survived, near certain death, but possible divine intervention and miracle cure. Of course, the lower one's class, the more virulent one's punishment, to allow for the hardier constitutions of the toilers. Combinations and recurring strains provide sophistications to the basic idea.
Back to the problem.
And I hate those dark glasses.
I repeat, back to the problem.
We need to know more.
So they all say.
And I think we should speak to him.
Yes. Then we kill him.
Restraint. We speak to him. We shall find him again and ask him what he wants, and perhaps who he is. We shall keep quiet and be thoughtful, and we shall not kill him unless he needs to be killed.
We nearly spoke to him.
No sulking. It was preposterous. We are not here to chase cars and run after idiot recluses. We plan, we think. We shall send a note to the gentleman's hotel.
The Excelsior? Really, one would have hoped such a respected establishment might not have been so easily seduced by mere money.
Indeed. And then we shall go to him, or have him come to us.
Well, we certainly ought not to go to him. And as for him coming to us, he may refuse. Regret that, due to an unforeseen previous commitment prevents. Feel it would be unwise at this juncture. Perhaps another. Can you imagine how humiliating that would be?
Oh, all right. We'll kill him.
All right. We'll try to kill him. If he survives, we shall talk to him. If he survives, he will want to talk to us. Commendable plan. Must agree, no question. Left no choice. Mere formality.
The woman fell silent. The grey-haired man heaved at her hips with his great hands, and strange patterns of sweat broke from the unscarred areas of his face. The hands swirled and swept over the woman's rump, and she bit her bottom lip just a little as her body moved in a sweet impersonation. Flat beat on a white plain. Snow was falling. Numeral 7.
You know, he told the rock, I've got this really nasty feeling that I'm dying. But then, all my feelings are pretty nasty at the moment, come to think of it. What do you think?
The rock didn't say anything. He had decided that the rock was the centre of the universe, and he could prove it. But the rock just didn't want to accept its obviously important place in the overall scheme of things, at least not yet anyway. So he was left talking to himself. Or he could talk to the birds and the insects. Everything wavered again. Things like waves, like clouds of carrion birds, closed in on him, centering, zeroing, trapping his mind and picking it off like a rotten fruit under a machine gun. He tried to crawl away unobtrusively. He could see what was coming next. His life was going to flash before him. What an appalling thought. Mercifully, only bits of it came back to him, as if the images mirrored his smashed body. And he remembered things like sitting in a bar on a little planet, his dark glasses making strange patterns with the darkened window. He remembered a place where the wind was so bad they used to judge its severity by the number of trucks that got blown over each night. He remembered a tank battle in the great monoculture fields like seas of grass, all madness and submerged desperation, and commanders standing on the tanks and the areas of burning crop, slowly spreading, burning through the night, spreading darkness ringed by fire. The cultivated grassland was the reason for and prize of that war, and was destroyed by it. He remembered a hose playing under searchlit water, its silent coils writhing. He remembered the never-ending whiteness and the attritional tectonics of the crashing tabula bergs, the bitter end of a century's slow sleep. And a garden. He remembered the garden and a chair.
Scream!
He screamed, and started flapping his arms about, trying to work up enough of a run to get into the air and away from...
He hardly knew. He hardly moved either. His arms flapped a little and scraped a few more guano pellets away, but the ring of patient birds, clustered around him waiting for him to die, just looked on unfooled at this display of inadequately avian behaviour.
"Oh, all right," he mumbled,
and collapsed back, clutching his chest and staring into the bland blue sky. What was so terrible about a chair anyway? He started crawling again. He hauled himself around the little puddle, scraping his way through the dark pellets the birds had left, then at a certain point set off towards the waters of the lake. He got only so far, then stopped, turned back, and went on round the puddle again, scraping aside the black bird-shit pellets, apologising to the little insects he disturbed as he did so. When he got back to the place where he'd been earlier, he stopped and took stock. The warm breeze brought the smell of sulphur from the lake to him. And he was back in the garden again, remembering the smell of flowers. Once, there had been a great house, which stood in an estate bordered on three sides by a broad river, midway between the mountains and the sea. The grounds were full of old woods and well-grazed pastureland. There were rolling hills full of shy, wild animals, and winding paths and winding streams crossed by little bridges. There were follies and pergolas and ha-has, ornamental lakes and quiet rustic summer houses. Over the years and the generations, many children were born and brought up in the great house and played in the wonderful gardens that surrounded it. But there were four in particular whose story became important for people who had never seen the house or heard of the family's name. Two of the children were sisters, called D'Arconce and Livouette. One of the boys was their elder brother called Chiradanin, and they all shared the family name Zakalwe. The last child was not related to them, but came from a family that had long been allied to theirs. He was called Elithiomel. Chiradanin was the older boy. He could just remember the fuss when Elithiomel's mother came to the great house large with child, in tears, and surrounded by fussing servants and huge guards and weeping maids. For a few days, the attention of the whole house seemed to be centred on the woman with the child in her womb, and, though his sisters played happily on, glad of the lessened watchfulness of their nannies and guards, he already resented the unborn infant. The troop of royal cavalry came to the house a week later, and he remembered his father out on the broad steps leading down into the courtyard, talking calmly, his own men running quietly through the house, taking up positions at every window. Chiradanin ran to find his mother. As he ran through the corridors, he put one hand out in front of him as though holding reins, and with his other hand slapped one hip, making a 1-2-3, 1-2-3 clopping noise, pretending he was a cavalryman. He discovered his mother with the woman who had the child inside her. The woman was crying, and he was told to go away. The boy was born that night, to the sound of screams. Chiradanin noticed that the atmosphere in the house changed greatly after that, and everyone was at once even more busy than before, but less worried. For a few years he could torment the younger boy, but then Elithiomel, who grew faster than he did, started to retaliate, and an uneasy truce developed between the two boys. Tutors taught them, and Chiradanin gradually came to realise that Elithiomel was their favourite, always learning things more quickly than he did, always being praised for his abilities, developing so early, always being called advanced and bright and clever. Chiradanin tried hard to match him and gleaned a little recognition for not just giving up, but it never seemed that he was really appreciated. Their martial instructors were more evenly divided on their merits. Chiradanin was better at wrestling and strike fighting. Elithiomel, the more accomplished with gun and blade. Under proper supervision, the boy could get carried away sometimes, though Chiradanin was perhaps his equal with a knife. The two sisters loved them both, regardless, and they played through the long summers and the brief, cold winters, and apart from the first year after Elithiomel was born, spent a little of each spring and autumn in the big city, far down the river, where the parents of D'Arconce, Livouette and Chiradanin kept a tall townhouse. None of the children liked the place, though. Its garden was so small and the public park so crowded. Elithiomel's mother was always quieter when they went to the city, and cried more often, and went away for a few days every so often, all excited before she went,
then sobbing when she returned. They were in the city once, one fall, and the four children were keeping out of the way of the short-tempered adults when a messenger came to the house. They couldn't help but hear the screams, and so abandoned their toy war and ran out of the nursery onto the landing to peer through the railings down into the great hall, where the messenger stood, head down, and Alethiomel's mother screamed and shrieked. Sharadanine, Livweta, and Darkance's mother and father both held on to her, talking calmly. Finally, their father motioned the messenger away, and the hysterical woman slumped silent to the floor, a piece of paper crumpled in her hand. Father looked up then and saw the children, but looked at Alethiomel, not at Sharadanine. They were all sent to bed soon after. When they returned to the house in the country a few days later, Alethiomel's mother was crying all the time and did not come down for meals.
"Your father was a murderer. They put him to death because he killed lots of people."
Sharadanine sat with his legs dangling over the edge of the stone bulwark. It was a beautiful day in the garden, and the trees sighed in the wind. The sisters were laughing and giggling in the background, collecting flowers from the beds in the centre of the stone boat. The stone ship sat in the West Lake, joined to the garden by a short stone causeway. They had played pirates for a while, and then started investigating the flower beds on the upper of the boat's two decks. Sharadanine had a collection of pebbles by his side, and was throwing them, one at a time, down into the calm water, producing ripples that looked like an archery target as he tried always to hit the same place.
"He didn't do any of those things," Alethiomel said, kicking the stone bulwark, looking down. "He was a good man. If he was good, why did the king have him killed? I don't know. People must have told tales about him, told lies. But the king's clever,"
Sharadanine said triumphantly, throwing another pebble into the spreading circle of waves.
"Cleverer than anybody. That's why he's king. He'd know if they were telling lies." "I don't care," Alethiomel insisted. "My father wasn't a bad man." "He was, and your mother must have been extremely naughty too, or they wouldn't have made her stay in her room all this time." "She hasn't been bad."
Alethiomel looked up at the other boy and felt something build up inside his head, behind his nose and eyes.
"She's ill. She can't leave her room."
"That's what she says," Sharadanine said.
"Look, millions of flowers. Look. We're going to make perfume. Do you want to help?"
The two sisters ran up behind them, arms full of flowers.
"Ellie!"
Darkance tried to take Alethiomel's arm. He pushed her away.
"Oh, Ellie! Sherry! Please don't!"
Livweta said.
"She hasn't been bad!"
he shouted at the other boy's back.
"Yes, she has!"
Sharadanine said in a sing-song voice and flicked another pebble into the lake.
"She hasn't!"
Alethiomel screamed and ran forward, pushing the other boy hard in the back. Sharadanine yelled and fell off the carved bulwark. His head struck the stonework as he fell. The two girls screamed. Alethiomel leant over the parapet and saw Sharadanine splash into the centre of his many-layered circle of waves. He disappeared, came back up again, and floated, face down. Darkance screamed.
"Oh, Ellie! No!"
Livweta dropped all her flowers and ran towards the steps. Darkance kept on screaming and squatted down on her haunches, back against the stone bulwark, crushing her flowers to her chest.
"Darkle, run to the house!"
Livweta cried from the staircase. Alethiomel watched the figure in the water move weakly, producing bubbles, as Livweta's steps sounded slapping on the deck underneath. A few seconds before the girl jumped into the shallow water to haul her brother out, and while Darkance screamed on, Alethiomel swept the remaining pebbles off the parapet, sending them pattering and plopping into the water around the boy.
No, that wasn't it. It had to be something worse than that, didn't it? He was sure he remembered something about a chair. He remembered something about a boat, too. But that didn't seem to be quite it, either. He tried to think of all the nastiest things that could happen in a chair. Dismissed them one by one as they hadn't happened to him or to anybody he knew, at least as far as he could remember. And finally concluded that his fixation on the idea of a chair was a random thing. It just so happened to be a chair, and that was all there was to it. Then there were the names. Names that he'd used, pretend names that didn't really belong to him. Imagine calling himself after a ship.
What a silly person. What a naughty boy. That was what he was trying to forget. He didn't know. He didn't understand how he could have been so stupid. Now it all seemed so clear, so obvious. He wanted to forget about the ship. He wanted to bury the thing, so he shouldn't go calling himself after it. Now he realized. Now he understood. Now, when it was too late to do anything about it. He made himself want to be sick. A chair, a ship, something else. He forgot.
The boys learned metalwork. The girls pottery.
But we're not peasants or artisans, Elithiamel provided.
You will not argue, and you shall learn something of what it is to work with materials, Shiradanin's father told the two boys.
But it's common.
So is learning how to write and to work with numbers. Proficiency in those skills will not make you clerks any more than working with iron will make you blacksmiths. But you will do as you are told. If it is more in accord with the martial ambitions you both lay claim to, you may attempt to construct blades and armour in the course of your lessons.
The boys looked at each other.
You might also care to tell your language tutor that I instructed you to ask him whether it is acceptable for young men of breeding to begin almost every sentence with the unfortunate word but. That is all.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Outside, they agreed that metalwork might not be so bad after all.
But we've got to tell Big Nose about saying but. We'll get lines.
No, we won't. Your old man said that we might care to tell Big Nose. That's not the same as actually telling us to tell him.
Ha, yeah.
Livueta wanted to take up metalwork too, but her father would not allow her to. It was not seemly. She persevered. He would not relent. She sulked. They compromised on carpentry. The boys made knives and swords, Darkon's pots, and Livueta the furniture for a summer house deep in the estate. It was in that summer house where Shiradanin discovered...
No, he didn't want to think about that, thank you. He knew what was coming. Damn it, he'd rather think about the other bad time, the day with the gun they'd taken from the armory. Nah, he didn't want to think at all.
He tried to stop thinking about it all by bashing his head up and down, staring at the mad blue sky, and hitting his head up, down off the pale, scaly rocks beneath his head, where the guano pellets had been swept away. But it hurt too much, and the rocks just gave, and he didn't have the strength seriously to threaten a determined speckfly anyway. So he stopped. Where was he?
Ah, yes. The crater. The drowned volcano.
We're in a crater.
An old crater in an old volcano, long dead and filled with water. And in the middle of the crater there was a little island, and he was on the little island, and he was looking off the little island at the crater walls. And he was a man, wasn't he, children? And he was a nice man. And he was dying on the little island, and... Scream? He said.
Doubtfully, the sky looked down. It was blue. It had been Elithiamel's idea to take the gun. The armory was unlocked, but guarded at the moment. The adults seemed busy and worried all the time, and there was talk of sending the children away. The summer had passed, and still they hadn't gone to the city. They were getting bored. We could run away. They were scuffing through the fallen leaves and a path through the estate. Elithiamel talked quietly. They couldn't even walk out here now without guards. The men kept 30 paces ahead and 20 behind. How could you play properly with all these guards around? Back nearer the house, they were allowed out without guards, but that was even more boring.
Don't be silly, Livueta said. It's not silly, Darkon said. We could go to the city. It would be something to do.
Yes, Shiradanin said. You're right, it would be.
Why do you want to go to the city? Livueta said. It might be dangerous there.
Well, it's boring here, Darkon said.
Yeah, it is, Shiradanin agreed. We could take a boat and sail away, Shiradanin said. We wouldn't even really have to sail or row, Elithiamel said. All we'd have to do is push the boat out, and we'd end up in the city eventually anyway.
I wouldn't go, Livueta said, kicking at a pile of leaves. Oh, Livy, Darkon said. Now you're being boring. Come on, we've got to do things together.
I wouldn't go, Livueta repeated.
Alethiumel pressed his lips together. He kicked hard at a huge pile of leaves, sending them up into the air like an explosion. A couple of the guards turned round quickly, then relaxed, looked away again.
We've got to do something, he said, looking at the guards ahead, admiring the big automatic rifles they were allowed to use.
He'd never even been allowed to touch a proper big gun, just piddling little small-bore pistols and light carbines. He caught one of the leaves as it fell past his face.
Leaves.
He turned the leaf this way and that in front of his eyes.
Trees are stupid, he told the others. Of course they are, Livueta said. They don't have nerves and brains, do they? I don't mean that, he said, crumpling the leaf in his hands. I mean they're such a stupid idea. All this waste every autumn. A tree that kept its leaves wouldn't have to grow new ones. It would grow bigger than all the rest. It would be the king of the trees.
But the leaves are beautiful, Darkon said.
Alethiumel shook his head, exchanging looks with Sharadanin.
Girls, he laughed, sneering.
He forgot what the other word was for a crater. There was another word for a crater, for a big volcanic crater. There was definitely another word for it. There was absolutely and positively another word for it. I just put it down for a minute here, and now some bastard swiped it. The bastard! If I could just find it, I just put it down here a minute ago.
Where was the volcano? The volcano was on a big island on an inland sea somewhere. He looked around at the distant heights of the crater walls, trying to remember where this somewhere was. As he moved, his shoulder hurt where one of the robbers had stabbed him. He'd attempted to protect the wound by shooing the clouds of flies away, but he was fairly sure they'd already laid their eggs. Not too near the heart. At least he still carried her there, and it would take a while for the corruption to spread that far. He'd be dead by then, before they found their way to his heart and her. But why not?
Go ahead. Be my guests, little maggots. Eat away, sup your fill.
Quite probably I'll be dead anyway by the time you hatch, and will save you the pain and torment of my attempts to scratch you out. Dear little maggots. Sweet little maggots. Sweet little me. I'm the one that's being eaten.
He paused and thought about the pool, the little puddle that he orbited around like a captured rock. It was at the bottom of a small depression, and it seemed to him that he kept on trying to get out, away from the stinking water and the slime and the flies that crowded around it, and the bird shit he kept crawling through. He didn't manage it. He always seemed to end up back here for some reason, but he thought about it a lot. The pool was shallow, muddy, rocky and smelly. It was foul and horrid and bloated past its normal limits with the sickness and the blood that he had spilled out into it. He wanted to leave, to get well away from it. Then he would send in a heavy bomber raid. He started to crawl again, hauling himself round the pool, disturbing pellets and insects, and heading off towards the lake at one point, then coming back to the same point as before, and stopping, gazing transfixed at the pool and the rock. What had he been doing? Helping the locals, as usual. Honest counsel, advisor, keeping the loonies at bay and people sweet. Later leading a small army. But they'd assumed he'd betrayed them, and that he'd used the army he'd trained as his own power base. So on the eve of their victory, the very hour they'd finally stormed the sanctum, they'd struck at him too. They'd taken him to the furnace room, stripped him naked. He'd escaped, but soldiers had been pounding down the stairs and he'd had to run. He'd been forced into the river when they cornered him again. The dive almost knocked him out. Currents took him and he spun, lazily. He woke up in the morning under a winch housing on a big river barge. He had no idea how he got there. There was a rope trailing astern, and he could only guess he'd climbed up that. His head still hurt. He took some clothes which were drying on a line behind the wheelhouse, but he was seen. He dived overboard with them, swam to the shore. He'd still been hounded, and all the time he was forced further away from the city and sanctum, where the culture might look for him. He spent hours trying to work out how to contact them. He'd been on a stolen mount, skirting the edge of a water-filled volcanic crater, when the robbers struck. They'd beaten him and raped him,
and cut the tendons in his legs and tossed him into the stinking, yellow-tinged waters of the crater lake, then thrown boulders at him as he tried to swim away, using only his arms, legs floating uselessly behind him. He knew one of the rocks would hit him sooner or later, so he tried to coax up some of that wonderful culture training, quickly hyperventilated, and then dived. He only had to wait a couple of seconds. A big rock splashed into the water in the line of bubbles he'd left when he dived. He embraced the rock like a lover as it wobbled down towards him and let it take him deep into the darkness of the lake, switching off the way he'd been taught to, but not really caring very much if it didn't work and he never woke up again. He'd thought 10 minutes when he dived. He woke up in crushing darkness, remembered, and dragged his arms out from under the rock. He kicked for the light, but nothing happened. He used his arms. The surface came down to meet him eventually. Air had never tasted so sweet. The walls of the crater lake were sheer. The tiny rock island was the only place to swim to. Screeching birds lifted from the island as he thrashed his way ashore. At least, he thought, as he dragged himself onto the rock through the guano, it wasn't the priests that found me. Then I'd really have been in trouble. The bends set in a few minutes later, like slow acid seeping into every joint, and he wished the priests had got him. Still, he told himself, talking to keep his mind away from the pain, they would come for him. The culture would come down with a beautiful big ship, and they would take him up and make it all better. He was sure they would. He'd be looked after and made better, and he'd be safe, very safe, and well looked after and free from pain, back in their paradise, and it would be like being a child again. Like being in the garden again. Except, some rogue part of his mind reminded him, bad things happened in gardens too, sometimes. D'Arconce got the armory guard to help her with a door that was stuck along the corridor, just round the corner. Chiradinine slipped in and took the auto-rifle Elithumel had described. He got back out, covering the gun in a cape, and heard D'Arconce thanking the guard profusely. They all met up in the rear hall cloakroom, where they whispered excitedly in the comforting smell of wet cloth and floor polish, and took turns holding the gun. It was very heavy. "There's only one magazine. I couldn't see the others. God, you're blind, Zack. Have to do, I suppose."
"Ugh, it's oily," D'Arconce said.
"That stops rust," Chiradinine explained.
"Where are we supposed to let it off?"
Livueta asked. "We'll hide it here, then get out after dinner," Elithumel said, taking the weapon from D'Arconce. "It's big nose for studies, and he always sleeps right through anyway. Mother and father will be entertaining that colonel. We can get out of the house and into the woods and fire..." Not let off, actually. Fire the gun there.
"We'll probably get killed," Livueta said. "The guards will think we're terrorists."
Elithumel shook his head patiently.
"Livy, you are stupid."
He pointed the gun at her.
"It's got a silencer. What do you think this bit is?"
"Huh," Livueta said, pushing the point away from her.
"Has it got a safety catch?"
Elithumel looked uncertain for just a moment.
"Of course," he said loudly,
then flinched a little and glanced at the closed door to the hall.
"Of course," he whispered. "Come on, we'll hide it here and come back for it when we've got away from Big Nose." "You can't hide it here," Livueta said.
"Bet I can."
"It smells too much," Livueta said. "The oil smells. You'd smell it as soon as you walked in here. What if Father decides to go for a walk?"
Elithumel looked worried. Livueta moved past him, opened a small high window.
"How about hiding it on the stone boat?" Chiradinine suggested. "Nobody ever goes there at this time of year."
Elithumel thought about this. He grabbed the cloak Chiradinine had wrapped the gun in originally and covered the weapon again.
"All right, you take it."
Still not far enough back. Or not far enough forward, he wasn't sure. The right place. That was what he was looking for. The right place. Place was all important. Place meant everything. Take this rock. "Take you, rock," he said.
He squinted at it.
"Ah, yes. Here we have the nasty big flat rock sitting doing nothing, just amoral and dull, and it sits like an island in the polluted pool. The pool is a tiny lake on the little island, and the island is in a drowned crater.
The crater is a volcanic crater. The volcano forms part of an island in a big inland sea. The inland sea is like a giant lake on a continent, and the continent is like an island sitting in the seas of the planet. The planet is like an island in the sea of space within its system, and the system floats within the cluster, which is like an island in the sea of the galaxy, which is like an island in the archipelago of its local group, which is an island within the universe. The universe is like an island floating in a sea of space in the continua, and they float like islands in the reality and... But down through the continua, the universe, the local group, the galaxy, the cluster, the system, the planet, the continent, the island, the lake, the island, the rock remained... And that meant the rock. The crappy... Awful rock here was the centre of the universe, the continua, the whole reality. The word was caldera. The lake was in a drowned caldera. He raised his head, looked out over the still yellowish water towards the crater cliffs, and seemed to see a boat made of stone. Scream, he said. Piss off, he heard the sky say, unconvinced. The sky was full of cloud, and it was getting dark early. Their language tutor took longer than usual to fall asleep behind his high desk, and they almost decided to abandon the whole plan until tomorrow, but couldn't bear to. They crept out of the classroom, then walked as normally as they could down to the rear hall, where they picked up their boots and jackets. See, Livweta whispered, it smells a bit of gun oil anyway. I can't smell any, Alethiumel lied. The banqueting rooms, where a visiting colonel and his staff were being wined and dined that evening, faced the parks to the front of the house. The lake with the stone boat was at the rear. Just going to walk around the lake, Sergeant, Shiradinin told the guard, who stopped them on the gravel path towards the stone boat. The sergeant nodded, told them to walk quickly, it would soon be dark. They sneaked onto the boat, found the rifle where Shiradinin had hidden it under a stone bench on the upper deck. As he lifted it from the flagstone deck, Alethiumel knocked the gun against the side of the bench. There was a snapping noise, and the magazine fell off. Then there was a noise like a spring, and bullets clicked and clattered over the stones. Idiot, Shiradinin said. Shut up.
Oh, no, Livweta said, bending down and scooping up some of the rounds. Let's go back, Darkance whispered. I'm frightened.
Don't worry, Shiradinin said, patting her hand. Come on. Look for the bullets. It seemed to take ages to find them and clean them and press them back into the magazine. Even then, they thought there were probably a few missing. By the time they'd finished and got the magazine slotted back into place, it was almost night.
It's far too dark, Livweta said.
They were all crouched down at the balustrade, looking out over the lake to the house. Alethiumel held the gun.
No, he said. We can still see.
No, we can't. Not properly, Shiradinin told him.
Let's leave it till tomorrow, Livweta said.
They'll notice we're gone soon, Shiradinin whispered. We haven't got the time.
No,
Alethiumel said, looking out to where the guard walked slowly past the end of the causeway. Livweta looked too. It was the sergeant who'd talked to them.
You're being an idiot, Shiradinin said, and put one hand out, taking hold of the gun.
Alethiumel pulled away. It's mine. Leave it.
It is not yours, Shiradinin hissed. It's ours. It belongs to our family, not yours.
He got both hands on the gun. Alethiumel pulled back again.
Stop it,
Darkon said, her voice tiny.
Don't be so...
Livweta started to say. She looked over the edge of the parapet to where she thought she'd heard a noise.
Give it here. Let it go. Please stop. Please stop. Let's go back in, please.
Livweta didn't hear them. She was staring, wide-eyed, dry-mouthed, over the stone parapet. A black-covered man picked up the rifle the guard sergeant had dropped. The guard sergeant himself lay on the gravel. Something glittered in the black-dressed man's hand, reflecting the light of the house. The man pushed the slack form of the sergeant off the gravel into the lake. Her breath caught in her throat. Livweta ducked down. She flapped her hands at the boys.
"St,"
she said. They still struggled.
"St. Mine! Let go! Stop!"
she hissed, and struck them both on the head. They both stared at her.
Somebody just killed that sergeant, just out there.
What? Both boys looked over the parapet. Alethiumel still held the gun. Darkance squatted down and started to cry.
Where? There. That's his body. There in the water.
Sure, Alethiumel said in a whispered drawl. And who?
The three of them saw one shadowy figure move towards the house, keeping in the shade of the bushes bordering the path. A dozen or so men, just patches of darkness on the gravel, moved along the side of the lake, where there was a narrow strip of grass.
Terrorists!
Alethiamel said excitedly, as the three all ducked back behind the balustrade, where Darkons wept quietly.
Tell the house, Livoita said. Fire the gun!
Take the silencer off first, Sharadanin said. Alethiamel struggled with the end of the barrel.
It's stuck. Let me try.
All three tried.
Fire it anyway, Sharadanin said.
Yeah, Alethiamel whispered. He shook the gun, hefted it.
Yeah, he said.
He knelt, put the gun on the stone bulwark, sighted.
Be careful, Livoita said.
Alethiamel aimed at the dark men crossing the path towards the house. He pulled the trigger. The gun seemed to explode. The whole deck of the stone boat lit up. The noise was tremendous. Alethiamel was thrown back, gun still firing, blasting tracer into the night sky. He crashed into the bench. Darkance shrieked at the top of her lungs. She leapt up, firing sounded from near the house.
Darkle, get down! Livoita screamed.
Lines of light flickered and cracked above the stone boat. Darkance stood, screaming, then started to run for the stairs. Alethiamel shook his head, looked up as the girl ran past him. Livoita grabbed at her and missed. Sharadanin tried to tackle her. The lines of light lowered, detonating chips of rock off the stones all around them in tiny clouds of dust, at the same time as Darkance, still screaming, stumbled to the stairs. The bullet entered Darkance through the hip. The other three heard, quite distinctly, the noise that it made above the gunfire and the girl's scream. He was hit too, though he didn't know by what at the time. The attack on the house was beaten off. Darkance lived. She almost died from loss of blood and shock. But she lived. The best surgeons in the land fought to rebuild her pelvis, shattered into a dozen major pieces and 100 splinters by the impact of the round. Bits of bone had travelled her body. They found fragments in her legs, in one arm, in her internal organs, even a piece in her chin. The army surgeons were fairly used to dealing with that sort of injury, and they had the time, because the war hadn't yet started then, and the incentive, for her father was a very important man, to put her back together as best they could. Still, she would walk awkwardly until she stopped growing, at least. One of the bone shards travelled further than her own body. It entered his, just above the heart. The army surgeons said it would be too dangerous to operate. In time, they said, his body would reject the fragment of bone. But it never did. He started to crawl round the pool again. Caldera. That was the word. The name. Such signals were important, and he'd found the one he'd been looking for. Victory, he said to himself, as he hauled himself round, scattering a last few of the bird droppings out of his way and apologising to the insects. Everything was going to be just fine, he decided. He knew that, now, and knew that in the end you always won, and that even when you lost, you never knew. And there was only one fight, and he was at the centre of the whole ridiculous thing anyway, and Caldera was the word, and Zakalwe was the word, and Stabarind was the word, and... They came for him. They came down with a big, beautiful ship, and they took him up and away, and they made him all better again. They never learn, the sky sighed quite distinctly. Fuck you, he said. It was years later that Sharadanin, returned from the military academy and looking for Darkance and sent in that direction by a monosyllabic gardener, walked up the soft carpet of leaves to the door of the little summer house. He heard a scream from inside. Darkance. He dashed up the steps, drawing his pistol, and kicked the door open. Darkance's startled face twisted over her shoulder, regarding him. Her hands were still clasped round Alethiamel's neck. Alethiamel sat, trousers round his ankles, hands on Darkance's naked hips under her bunched-up dress, and looked calmly at him. Alethiamel was sitting on the little chair that Livoita had made in her carpentry class long ago. "Hi there, old chap," he said to the young man holding the pistol. Sharadanin looked into Alethiamel's eyes for a moment, then turned away, holstering the pistol and buttoning the holster, and walking out, closing the door behind him. Behind him, he heard Darkance crying, and Alethiomel laughing. The island in the centre of the caldera became quiet again. Some birds flew back to it. The island had changed, thanks to the man. Scraped in a circle all round the central depression of the islet, drawn in a pathway of black bird droppings cleared away from the pale rock, and with the appropriate tail of just the right length leading off to one side, its other end pointing at the rock which was the central dot, the island seemed to have a letter or simple pictogram printed on it, white on black. It was the local signal for "Help me," and you would only have seen it from an aircraft, or from space. A few years after the scene in the summer house, one night while the forests burned and the distant artillery thundered, a young army major jumped up onto one of the tanks under his command and ordered the driver to take the machine through the woods, following a path which wound between the old trees. They left behind the shell of the recaptured mansion and the glowing red fires which lit its once grand interior. The fires reflected on the waters of an ornamental lake by the wreckage of a demolished boat made of stone. The tank ripped through the woods, demolishing small trees and little bridges over streams. He saw the clearing with the summer house through the trees. It was lit by a flickering white light as though by God. They got to the clearing. A star shell had fallen into the trees above, its parachute entangled in the branches. It sizzled and sputtered and shed a pure, sharp, extreme light all over the clearing. Inside the summer house, the little wooden chair was quite visible. The tank's gun was pointing straight at the small building.
"Sir?"
the tank commander said, peering worriedly from the hatch beneath. Major Zakalwe looked down at him.
"Fire," he said.
Chapter 8. The first snow of the year settled over the upper slopes of the cleft city. It floated out of the grey-brown sky and fitted itself over the streets and the buildings like a sheet thrown over a corpse. He dined alone at a large table. The screen he had wheeled into the middle of the brightly lit room flickered with the images of released prisoners from some other planet. The balcony doors were lying open, and through them drifted small examples of the falling snow. The rich carpet of the room was frosted.